Hello, I'm Claire White, and this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We are here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and stories. And today is a special week because we have our producer, James Foley, filling in for Kyle.
Hello.
Yes, Kyle apparently is on a boat in Annapolis. Something ridiculous. But anyway, he couldn't be here, and we're very excited to have James, despite everything Kyle says about him.
That's right.
And today, we are going to be talking about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Yeah.
It is the sequel to 2014's Guardians of the Galaxy. It is the 15th movie that takes place in the MCU, or the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it follows the adventures of Peter Quill, Gamora, Drax, Rocket the Raccoon, and Baby Groot, a.k.a. the Guardians of the Galaxy. It's directed by James Gunn and stars Chris Pratt, Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista, Vin Diesel, and Bradley Cooper, among others. James is going to be talking about the history of the Guardians of the Galaxy. What are you going to be talking about, James? I never do this, so I never have to say what anyone's talking about.
I'm going to be talking about the motley crew that make up the Guardians of the Galaxy and maybe just a little bit about Cosmic Marvel.
Okay, that sounds fantastic. And I will be talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the creation of Guardians of the Galaxy, why they got made into a movie in the first place. So, James, take it away.
So the big thing that I want to manage to do is get you to know who the Guardians of the Galaxy are, at least in their current iteration, in the comics and in the films. And it's a crazy thing that we're even talking about them, that these characters that have labored in obscurity for decades are now starring in a blockbuster film. So a little bit about who they have been and who they are now. So to start, most importantly, Chris Pratt's character in the film, Star-Lord, also known as Peter Quill. So he was created by Steve Englehart and Steve Gann in Marvel Preview number 4 back in 1976.
Wow, I didn't realize they were that old.
Well, yeah, he's that old. The Guardians as a team name is like 50 years old.
Ooh.
Yeah, it goes back to the Bronze Age, back to, you know, the Pulp
Not the
fiction.
Literal Bronze Age.
No, not the literal Bronze Age. That's a good note to make. anyway, so I love Steve Englehart's description of him, and it helps to give you an idea of how much this character has grown and how much of that is because of how Chris Pratt plays him, how different he is than this, although, you know, some similarities remain. Steve Englehart called his character an unpleasant, introverted jerk.
Oh, that's not the Peter Quill from the movies.
No, it's not at all. And so, okay, so here's his thing of how he envisioned him and how he had to leave him. Okay, it's a good quote. It's a few sentences, though, so bear with me. I conceived something very large. My hero would go from being an unpleasant, introverted jerk to the most cosmic being in the universe, and I would tie it into my then-new interest in astrology. After his earthbound beginning, his mind would be opened step by step with a fast action story on Mercury, a love story on Venus, a war story on Mars, and so on out to the edge of the solar system and then beyond. But after his earthbound beginning, where I established him as an unpleasant introverted jerk, I left Marvel, so no one ever saw what he was to become. So I love that. I love that idea that you have this grand vision of a jerk who becomes something like a cosmic being, but you never get past stage one.
He's just a jerk.
He's just a jerk for decades. Now he's a jerk that gains all kinds of experience about alien cultures and customs and technology and weapons and, you know, has all kinds of adventures, but he's still an introverted jerk. And when I went back and was reading the comics that I was told were the beginning of the current Guardians of the Galaxy, when I was looking at Peter Quill as Star-Lord in Annihilation Conquest from back in around 2007, the guy I saw was still not Chris Pratt. It was still an introverted jerk, just a very knowledgeable and dangerous introverted jerk. But that's one of those changes that happens with the movies and that is now in the comics. So Anyway, little bit of a backstory compared from the comics to the movies. No matter what, Peter Quill is an orphan, and he's got a human mother and some kind of other being father. In the comics, it's the alien Jason, which is like a space version of the name Jason. You just have a J and then an apostrophe.
Oh, humans and aliens have the same ideas. Who knew?
Yep, they add an apostrophe because they're aliens, though. That's the difference. Anyway, what ends up happening is that aliens kill Peter Quill's mother because they're trying to end his father's bloodline. These are aliens that his father is fighting a war against. So that is the same. Peter Quill is always going to be an orphan, and there's always going to be that mix of space in his origin as a child. But in the comics, he gets into space because he becomes an astronaut for NASA, gets stranded, and is picked up by the Ravagers, including Yondu, who is in the films as a blue-haired, fin-wearing alien with a sonic-controlled arrow, much like the comics, but is played instead of a brother figure as a much older father figure. And he's also, just little note, the only original member of the Guardians of the Galaxy that makes it into the films.
Oh.
Yeah, pretty cool side note. Anyway, I want to move on from Peter Quill to Drax the Destroyer, who's played by Dave Bautista, who's created by Jim Starlin, who also created Thanos.
Big baddie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yes.
With all these movies are leading to.
All roads lead to Thanos. He was created in Iron Man number 55 in 1973. And some have described him as just Space Hulk. Just big, angry, strong, trying to
get
Thanos.
Is he as strong as the Hulk?
No. No, but still very, very strong. Originally, his backstory, and this is going to be a favorite of Jim Starlin's, you'll see when we get to Gamora, but him and his family were killed by Thanos because he was driving in a car with his wife and his kids. Thanos was on Earth, saw him, and was like, hey, I think they saw me, so he killed his family. The cosmic being Kronos took his soul, the soul of Drax, and put him in the new Drax body and said, hey, would you like to get revenge on Thanos?
In the movie, it's a different backstory, right?
Yes, yes. Now, still the same, where Thanos is responsible for the death of his family, but they make him an alien instead of a human man reborn by a cosmic being. Anyway, his original powers included telepathy, super strength, resilience, flight, energy blasts out of his hands. But as he gets reincarnated in different bodies after dying, oftentimes to Thanos, it's a hard job being the one who is tasked with killing Thanos. He gets the new slimmer version that we see in 2005, 2006, and that we see in the film.
That's what the film based it off
of. Yeah, now when I say slimmer, that man is jacked out of his mind, but that's slimmer than a space version of the Incredible Hulk. Anyway, moving on to Gamora, you can see how Jim Starlin likes that your family was wiped out, would you like revenge? which is, you know, great origin story. Gamora is played by Zoe Saldana, and as I said, she was created by Jim Starlin in Strange Tales number 180 back in 1975. So these are reborn 70s characters. She is the adopted daughter of Thanos, and the way that happened is that there was a genocide on her whole people. She's the last one. Thanos adopts this little girl and says, hey, I can make you more powerful. You serve me, and we'll get revenge on the awful people that took out all of your people. She says yes to that deal. He enhances her. She gets superhuman strength, agility, healing. And here's the big thing about her is that beyond those enhancements and her superhuman abilities, she's just a great martial artist, one of the best in the galaxy. Her tagline is, the deadliest woman in the whole galaxy.
Ooh. So she's better than anyone we've met in the Marvel Cinematic Universe so far. At least as far as the women go. I'm thinking Black Widow.
Yes.
She's not as powerful as Scarlet Witch.
Right. Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by deadly. Scarlet Witch can just alter your whole reality.
Right, she can't do that.
But as far as fighting, as far as you want to go up against somebody with superhuman strength and a knowledge of weapons, oh my goodness. As far as the galaxy is concerned, there is no finer. And by the way, talking about how people have been changed for the comics, one of the things that happened after her portrayal in the movie by Zoe Saldana is that they softened her up a bit. In the comics. So she has a softer side. She's more nuanced than just
not in her drawing, but just in her personality.
Well, also her drawing in that they put some clothes on her.
Oh, that's nice.
Yes. Isn't that a funny influence of the movie? You wouldn't expect that out of a film, would you? To make the comics go, oh, I guess we're going to make
I would.
Yeah.
Comics are pretty risque.
Yes.
As far as the female characters go, especially in the 80s and 70s.
Especially right now. But it's notable when they change, and she became more three-dimensional as far as having a softer
side. More PG-13.
Yes, more PG-13, and also, like, putting some clothes on. Also, Drax, who we were talking about earlier, more funny. And they took the way he speaks in the movie and put it into his comic dialogue.
He's great in the movie.
Yeah. So, moving on from her, and also, just how cool is it that she is so much more powerful than Peter Quill? Like, no question.
That is cool.
Could break him in a
moment.
She's
a daughter of Thanos.
Yeah.
When you hear that, you think... Oh, she's scary.
A daughter of Thanos can take out Chris Pratt. Anyway, on to the two characters that are the one where you're like, wait, this is a movie? They spent how much making? They're putting a cartoon raccoon in this? A raccoon whose real origin story, in a way, is like one of the animals that was sent into space back when we were still figuring things out in the 60s, right? Anyway, he's played by Bradley Cooper. He was created by Bill Mantlow and Keith Giffen. His abilities are that he's a master tactician and leader, sometimes in the comics being the leader of the Guardians.
Don't get that from the movie, but okay.
I think you can kind of see it. He's responsible for a lot. The leadership thing,
he's not quite there.
Not quite there. So he, of course, has all the abilities of a raccoon. Just enhanced. And in the comics, that's through genetic enhancements. In the movie, it's cybernetic. Also, in the comics, he has really enhanced intuition. He can just figure out what the thing to do is to get the best result in any given situation. So he's a genius tactician. In the movies, they make it so he can figure out the thing to build. He's just amazing with technology. Going on from Rocket Raccoon, even better than a talking raccoon, they're making a blockbuster movie in the Marvel Universe with a talking tree.
With an ant.
Yes, with an ant. With a space ant. That's one of my points, is space ant. He's played by Vin Diesel, created by Jack Kirby in Tales to Astonish number 13 back in 1960.
Oh, that's cool. Jack Kirby.
Yes. Who
we always talk about in the podcast.
Look up Jack Kirby, guys. You want to know why space looks like it does in comics? The answer is Jack Kirby. Anyway, technically, Groot is a floral colossus of the planet X, Space Ent, which is from The Lord of the Rings, by the way. Treebeard, if you're not familiar.
Google that. You'll get some good images.
He has many backstories. His original one is that he showed up on Earth back in 1960 to capture humans to experiment on. Since then, he's had several. But in the main ones...
Several what?
Backstories.
Oh, okay.
Where
I thought several humans.
Yeah, he's had several humans. No, on Planet X, he's exiled in most of his backstories because he wants to protect a mammal, either one of like the squirrel creatures that maintain the trees, or the tree people, or a human girl that some other tree person kidnapped. And they're like, get out of here.
Gentle giant.
Yeah, you got to side with the trees every time, Groot. Get out. So anyway, in the movie and in the comics, eventually he hooks up with Rocket Raccoon and he's a space criminal tree, but still a good person. I think we can tell.
I'm down for any ant in space.
And if you saw the first movie, I'm sure everyone's seen the trailers. There's a baby Groot in this film.
Oh, it's the cutest thing in the world.
Little reborn sapling Groot. And when I looked up Groot to research him for the podcast, the first thing Google tried to do was sell me a baby Groot toy.
I mean, did you kind of want it?
Who doesn't want baby Groot? It's just too good.
Too cute.
Anyway, we can talk about that in the opinion segment. There's only one more character to talk about. Her name is Mantis. She's not in the original movie, but she is in the original formation of this Guardians of the Galaxy team, the one from 2008 that this is all based on. She is played by Pom Clementeef. She was created by Steve Englehart and Don Heck in The Avengers, number 112, back in 1973. A lot of 70s flavor for our space opera here. Her abilities, at least in the comics, are, well, several. But she has a telepathic empathy that allows her to feel other people's emotions. And she has extreme control of her body. She can stop her heartbeat or heal herself through sheer force of will. She can also create an astral self to travel, and she can even control plant life. There's something to do with her empathic abilities.
Ooh, poison yeah. ivy stuff there.
Yeah, yeah. Her backstory is crazy. She...
Because of comics,
but extra crazy. She's originally Vietnamese. She's ethnically half Vietnamese, half German. She's dropped off by her father as a child in a monastery to be raised and trained in those abilities, some of which I just mentioned. But it turns out this monastery is actually part of an alien space religion made up of Kree, of the Kree Empire that you come into contact with in the Guardians of the Galaxy. And it's there she learns that she may be the celestial Madonna who will give birth to a galactic savior. That's a lot. So you may not put her in the first movie, but she's in the original comic. And it's this thing of like, is she actually the celestial Madonna? She
thinks she is. It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, a lot of pressure. I want to wrap up by saying that if you're looking to jump into the Guardians of the Galaxy comics and see them in the way that they're portrayed in the movies and see why Marvel's writers thought, oh, these guys could star in a team movie in space, it's from the run done by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, known as the creative team DNA, with penciler Paul Pelletier. They wrote Guardians of the Galaxy from 2008 to 2010, after deciding that they were their favorite thing that they did in Annihilation Conquest. And that's where the team is formed, Dirty Dozen style, which is also Suicide Squad style, and have to save the galaxy as a bunch of ex-cons. And it's a really cool starting off point if you want to jump in.
Yeah, that sounds great. Maybe we can link to it on the Facebook page, too, where you can find it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
James, that was awesome. I want to congratulate you in doing your segment in a reasonable time. And I want to thank Laura, our producer who's filling in, for getting him there.
Yes.
You didn't hear the first cut of the Final Fantasy segment. Let me say it got slashed quite a bit.
It did. I did the editing to make me talk like a reasonable person.
Well, moving on to production. I want to start by talking about the MCU, or the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because each of the company's 14 films, and this is not including the first Hulk movie, over the past 8 years has opened in the first place at the domestic box office and brought in more than billion globally. That's a big difference.
Yes, it is. We know numbers.
Here at DSRA, we can do math. And I want to talk about how Marvel has structured this universe, because it's actually something that we haven't mentioned before, even though we've talked about Marvel multiple times on this podcast. So it structures itself in phases. And you might have, if you read articles about Marvel and what they're doing or reviews of Marvel movies, you might have heard about the phase system. Phase one are the first Marvel movies that led to the Avengers. So that would be Iron Man, The Incredible Hulk, which Marvel pretends didn't exist, Iron Man 2, Thor, Captain America, the First Avenger. Iron Man 3 started out Phase 2, and it concluded with Ant-Man. So that also includes Thor, The Dark World, Captain America, Winter Soldier, Guardians of the Galaxy, and Avengers, Age of Ultron. And right now, starting last year, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is in Phase 3. And it started off with Captain America Civil War and Doctor Strange. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, the movie we're talking about, is in Phase 3. And coming up in Phase 3 is Spider-Man Homecoming, Thor Ragnarok, Black Panther, Avengers Infinity War, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Captain Marvel, and Avengers 4. Now, there's nothing that they're calling Phase 4, and they might stop the phase system after Phase 3, but Marvel has committed to two films after Phase 3 ends, and that's Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 and the Spider-Man sequel. So the thing is, every Marvel movie released has been connected by the buildup to Thanos assembling the Infinity Gauntlet and the attack on the universe. So the question is, after Avengers 4 and Thanos is, we assume, defeated, what happens next? And how are they going to structure their movies after that? And that's a question that we'll probably answer in another podcast a few years from now, I assume. But I'm very interested to see what they do and how that's coming. Now, this phase model has been incredibly successful. And in fact, every studio in Hollywood is trying to copy it and has tried to have their own phase model and their own universe. So you can see it with Warner Brothers with the Harry Potter and the DC superhero movies, Fox with X-Men. Universal is doing it with Tom Cruise's Mummy movie. It's supposed to start the Monsters universe that they're going to be releasing after this. And Disney is taking a lesson from its own studio and using the system with the Star Wars movies. Now, phase one was more successful than anyone could have ever imagined. And if you think of these phases, they're kind of structuring them like comic books structure their releases. That's all that they did.
And, which I love.
Yeah, and it worked very well with comic book movies. Who knew? So after phase one, Marvel started working on the next step. And they realized that they couldn't sustain their studio by just making Avengers, Captain America, Iron Man sequels. They needed to introduce other characters. So in a sense, Guardians was kind of this big, expensive experiment. It was the first time that Marvel was banking on the Marvel Universe, not the characters, as a marketable entity. And it was basically a $150 million gamble. To make a movie about a comic no one had ever heard of, C-list characters, like you said. And people talk about what a risk it was, but the thing is, this whole Marvel Studios thing was a risk. It's just another risk that they took afterwards. Kevin Feige, he's the head of Marvel Studios, we talk about him a lot in the podcast, said that they made Guardians because they believed it was a compelling story and that they could make a cool movie for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now, back in 2009, Marvel had started a young writers program, which was basically a paid internship where they had five writers adapt half a dozen Marvel properties, hoping something could be developed. I think they just worked these writers as hard as they could for 2 years.
Sounds like a great idea.
It's such a good idea.
At intern rates?
Yeah.
Such a good idea.
Marvel makes money and they know how to cut costs. Nicole Perlman chose Guardians of the Galaxy because she was a science fiction fan and loved anything space-related. And she spent years refining the script. Eventually, Marvel brought in James Gunn to rewrite and direct it, which Perlman said was always understood that was going to be the case because they had such a positive experience with Joss Whedon for Avengers. But this was one of those original scripts that they saw and they liked and they continued to develop and realize that they could make a movie out of it. Also realize that there are five or four more scripts that they're just sitting on. And Perlman actually said that they just realized that they had so much material already that they couldn't develop all the other scripts that were being written. So in the future, we can look to that.
And that's the amazing thing about the Disney's purchase of Marvel Studios. We talk about what a risk it was to spend $4 billion on all that intellectual property. But one,
it's all that intellectual property.
All that intellectual property that you can take these young writers and say, hey, write whatever you think is interesting about this vast wealth of material.
Yeah. No, and Disney saw the potential. And also Marvel had the structure and the plans to make it work. It's amazing what they've done. I am always in awe when we talk about their business structure and how they've developed the storylines and even just hiring these young writers who were probably excited to be writing for a major film studio. I mean, for Perlman, this has helped her career. She's getting to write other scripts for other movie studios now.
Get hired as an intern and write a script that eventually becomes...
Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to just sign non-disclosure agreements. You can't work for anyone else. It is kind of a factory, but I'm not a writer, but maybe as a young writer starting off, that's a good thing to do. So I want to switch gears and talk about James Gunn, who is the director and the writer of Volume 2, and he helped rewrite Volume 1. He first started working for Troma Entertainment, and he wrote Tromeo and Juliet, which is a weird-looking trailer. I just watched the trailer. That was enough of a Romeo and Juliet interpretation, I guess it is. It's in New York in the 90s. It's a very 90s movie. He wrote the live-action Scooby-Doo. He worked on Dawn of the Dead. He wrote and directed Slither. He wrote Super, which I've heard of, kind of. It's a violent superhero comedy. And that kind of helped put him on the list for the Guardians movie. we've talked about this before, but Marvel kind of makes a list of directors who they're interested in to direct their property. And there's no order to who they want more than anyone else. They like to have meetings with them and feel the vibe in the meetings. And then they decide who they want to work with based on who they think they'd like to work with on countless movies, because that's always the plan, and who they think they can collaborate with well. And like we've said before, they don't have to have a huge impressive resumes. They don't have to have experience working with a huge crew, because Marvel knows how to work with a huge crew. Marvel has all the resources.
The machine is ready and waiting.
Yeah, just waiting for the little cog to go in there. And Feige said he knew he'd made the right choice for a director when he saw Gunn's revised script treatment and it had a color photo of a vintage Walkman on it. And that's when he knew, oh yeah, we picked the right guy. Gunn said that when he was first offered Guardians, he felt that he could fill a hole in what was missing with the space opera genre. He felt that it had become really dreary and he wanted to uplift it, make it more buoyant, kind of infuse some of that Raiders of the Lost Ark vibe into it, which I think he does with Guardians of the Galaxy. He was also terrified he was making a huge flop when he was working on the first one, and he consoled himself with the thought that he could always teach.
Oh my goodness. Oh my, he just realized, I have Bradley Cooper playing a talking raccoon and Vin Diesel playing a talking tree.
Yeah. Wouldn't you be terrified? I would be terrified. He didn't need to be. The first movie has a 91% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it became one of the biggest films of 2014. Internationally, as far as box office money goes, it came in right behind Transformers and The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, which, shame on the world.
Yeah.
For both of those, actually.
Yes.
Now you can really know my nerd snobbery.
Hey, nerd snobbery is how we feel about all those WB superhero movies.
Yeah. Oof. And the I don't even want to start talking about the Hobbit movies. So, Guardians of the Galaxy beat out, in 2014, Captain America Winter Soldier, X-Men Days of Future Past, and Amazing Spider-Man 2. So it was the highest-earning superhero movie of 2014. It demonstrated that Marvel could make their third-tier superheroes perform like A-list ones.
Or better.
And
yeah, I know it made
better
more money.
Than Captain America.
Better than, you know, a year or two prior, Superman Man of Steel. Mm-hmm. Warner Brothers made less money with Superman.
Yeah, and better than other Marvel properties that they sold to other studios. They're real A-listers like X-Men and Spider-Man. It also showed that people trusted the quote-unquote Marvel product. So if Marvel makes something, people will go see it. Gunn started writing the second one as soon as the first one was released, and he said that Marvel really didn't dictate any plot elements. The only restrictions that were set up were set in the first movie. So besides adhering to those, he could kind of do whatever he wanted. And he was really nervous about repeating himself in Volume 2, so he threw away the formula of the first movie. And then on April 17th of this year, 2017, James Gunn announced that he was returning to write and direct Guardians Volume 3. So before the second movie was even released, Marvel was like, oh, we're making a third.
I love their confidence.
I think they saw the movie and went, yeah, we can do another. And let's talk about how the movie's doing. Now, we're recording this on Saturday. The movie was released on Thursday night, and the real box office numbers are going to come in tomorrow on Sunday. So this might be a little bit off. But so far, it's earned over $100 million overseas, and it's looking like it's going to make about $250 million over the weekend. Domestically, it's looking like it'll make between $140 million and $170 million. It has a critic score of 81%, so lower than the first one, and it has an audience score of 89%, which is pretty good. Audiences are seeming to like it. Also, Guardians 2 is expected to perform better than Guardians 1. And I think it's looking like it's on track to do that. We'll see where it goes.
I thought that before I even heard the critics' scores. I thought it should probably do better.
Because people have become they've watched the first one. They know the characters. So they might actually go see this, even those who wouldn't have seen it in the first place.
Yes, the first one grew so much by word of mouth and everyone saying how wonderful it was, even if it was characters you hadn't heard of, it was in a brand you had. Now that they know the characters, so many people are going to see it before they even think about what critics are saying.
So I think this is a good position to segue. James, did you like Guardians Volume 2?
I loved it. I loved it. And the thing is, I think part of the critics score and it getting a 9% dip in its overall critics score from last time, even though it's still scoring well with critics, is that you're not surprised that it's a good movie, that you're not surprised that they can handle an ensemble so well, that they can manage to have a fun space adventure in a superhero movie. And so because that surprise isn't there, it loses a little of the extra credit it was getting last time.
Right. I saw the first Guardians opening weekend with some friends. I had zero expectations. I only went because they wanted to go. And I had such a good time. And I was so impressed that they were able to make a good movie, like you said earlier, with a talking raccoon and space ent that only says, "I am Groot." Now, here's the thing. I kind of lowered my expectations for the second one because I was nervous about it going in. How are they going to repeat it? It won't be as funny because I won't be surprised. And I had a great, like, amazing time. And actually, I think that the second movie was better than the first movie. I think the battle sequences were more coherent. I think the characters were more fleshed out and their dynamic was better written.
Yes, because I think not only did the writers have an easier time writing these people now that they had become familiar with them over those years of honing them, but also the actors had gotten to play them before. And
right.
You can see that in their comfort.
The writers were writing for these actors, not
yes.
These actors coming in and adapting a script just written for someone.
Right. Now the writers had seen the actual film that mm-hmm. was made and could make something based on the performances. You're right. You're right. My biggest takeaway from it, several big takeaways, but one of them was just how much I enjoyed spending time with these people, which I think is the original success of the Marvel franchise. The reason that any of this house has been built is Robert Downey Jr.'s performance as Iron Man in the original movie.
And how good he is. And that, actually, James Gunn in interviews said that when he was looking for Peter Quill, he was looking for a Robert Downey Jr. to play him. And Chris Pratt came in, and he wasn't the biggest actor who read for the part, and he wasn't in shape. No one thought of him as the superhero actor. But he had the charisma.
Yeah, and he got in shape.
He got in shape, and I think he is so good.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing about them trying to find their Robert Downey Jr. is that they didn't get someone to come up and do a Robert Downey Jr. impression in space. He's a very different character.
Yeah.
And you can see that it's a very conscious choice because Peter Quill in the comics is actually much more similar to Tony Stark, to Iron Man.
Oh.
Yeah. When you read the comics, it's funny because he's like a less handsome Iron Man in space, you know, where he's really good with technology. He's a womanizer, this smug dude. And of course, you know, Chris Pratt's portrayal does have some ego, but he's also been described as a bit of a man boy. And I don't, you know, a very charismatic man boy, which is so different from Robert Downey Jr.'s suave maturity. And that they had the sense to find someone who had the charisma and likability to anchor the franchise rather than just somebody who's like Robert Downey Jr.
Or just a big name.
Yeah. Yeah. That once again, like we talk about with Marvel Studios and the directors, it's less about your name selling it than you being a good artistic fit for this wonderful
right.
thing that they already have built.
They didn't need to get Tom Cruise to come in and play him.
Not necessary.
And something that could have taken a lesson from this is Suicide Squad, where they didn't have that charismatic character to bring it all together. I think they tried to do it with Will Smith.
And Margot Robbie. And both turn in good performances. But at the end of the day, Will Smith is just Will Smith dressed up as Deadshot.
And Harley Quinn is not the charismatic center that Peter Quill or Tony Stark are.
Yeah. Now, she could be. That character is very capable of it as an idea, as a character from the comics. And maybe in the future. But she wasn't utilized to the greatest extent she could have been there. And it's a great point to bring up Suicide Squad 2 because they're based on the same core idea.
Dirty Dozen.
Dirty Dozen. They're both Dirty Dozen ideas.
Except you actually like the characters in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes. Yes. And I think part of that, too, is the two different directions that the studios have staked out as their niches.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Marvel's is becoming ever more encompassing, where you have the dark and gritty Logan, but you can also have Guardians of the Galaxy.
Well, that's Fox.
And it's, yeah, but it's with those characters. Okay, so that's a good point. It's not in the same world, but still, one of the things the Guardians...
Dark and gritty Daredevil.
Yes, yes. And Luke Cage, and oh my goodness,
Jessica Jones. One of the darkest things I'd seen on TV in a while.
And that is in the shared universe, that they find the place to tell all kinds of stories because the Marvel universe is so encompassing. And
well, so is the DC universe.
Yes.
DC could open it up too. I mean, they're going to do Batgirl with Joss Whedon, which I am very excited about.
Yes, but they've been doing a bastardized version of the phases, where they never really laid the foundation that Marvel did. They're just trying to catch up immediately.
Well, the studios see that Marvel money, and they want it now.
Process be damned.
And DC also has such great intellectual property that they probably thought they could just do it. I mean, and for good reason. Batman is insanely popular.
Yeah, but they should have learned their lesson by now. Everyone knows who Superman is. And Zack Snyder directing a Superman movie still made less money than Marvel throwing out Guardians of the Galaxy, who no one had heard of until then.
Right.
Unless you're a deep comic book fan of a particular niche of comic books.
And people love to hate on the Marvel machine and how formulaic it is.
Not this podcast.
We admire it so much. And Doctor Strange I didn't love. But I did love this one. And I actually thought that this Guardians movie was less formulaic than the other Marvel movies were.
Yes, because it wasn't the team building. And one of the reasons it's impressive is that they weren't just doing an origin movie, which is the easiest kind to do, to mm-hmm. tell that beginning story, especially in comics where they're told so often, so you have many of those stories to pick
right.
from.
Also, I want to talk about Fox and Logan and Deadpool. And in our Logan podcast, we talked about how much money Marvel makes versus how much money Fox made on Logan and Deadpool. And it's an astounding difference. Marvel makes so much more money. And all these critics claim that Logan is so much better and so different. And it is really different. And it was really good. But last night, after thinking about the movie for a while and thinking about which movie I liked better, even though that Logan is more critically acclaimed, I liked Guardians way better than Logan. I had such a better time sitting in that movie theater. And I enjoyed watching Logan. I thought it was a good movie. But I would rather watch Guardians any day.
It's this thing with Guardians of the Galaxy, with being with all of those people, that I didn't want the film to end. Even though there was so much in it and so much action, and my eyes had a hard time continuing to keep up with it. But I didn't want to leave these people.
Right. And it's more fun. I had a great time.
Yes. And I think part of that is what's so cool about Cosmic Marvel, and it's cool about what you were saying in your segment about the movie Gunn wanted to make, the kind of science fiction movie that was fun and adventurous and didn't take itself as seriously. That gets right to the heart of Cosmic Comics in general, because Cosmic Comics are coming from a pulp fiction, science fiction tradition, one that is of adventure and the emotions of that exploration.
Yeah. It's a new frontier.
Yes, yes. And now that Marvel Comics has expanded its universe to the point that it actually is really encompassing the Marvel Universe, those galaxies that it's created, there's so many other kinds of stories that they can tell.
No, I'm very excited to see what Marvel does with this. And if they keep making movies like Guardians of the Galaxy, going to be so happy to keep watching. All in all, DSRA really enjoys the Marvel Universe. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Claire White.
And I'm James Foey.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com, and we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. You can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast. I can be found on Twitter at Along With Claire, that's CLAIRE.
You can find me at James Fowey Jr. on Twitter. That's F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R.
And you can find Kyle, who is on vacation right now, at Klex303. That's K-L-E-X-303. You can learn more about Guardians of the Galaxy and the MCU and the origin of the comics on our Facebook page. And we would love to hear what you think of Guardians of the Galaxy. Or did you like Logan better? Or did you like Suicide Squad better? We promise not to judge.
Oh, we'll judge you.
Our fill-in producer is Laura Princiata, and I think we could compare her to a sovereign because she is the perfect genetic specimen. Our logo is done by Patty Hyland, who strongly resembles Gamora. What did you call her?
The deadliest woman in the galaxy.
And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, who I think would make a good Ravager or space pirate. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.